Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, all of those places. And I've been told that if, in fact, you like this podcast and you leave a positive review, that it actually helps. I don't actually know how that works, but this is true. Jonathan Last joins us along with A.B. Stoddard. Jonathan, this is true? If people say nice things about pod?
100% true. Go to iTunes, leave a five-star review if you can think about it, and have 5 minutes, even like type out with your thumbs something nice about the show, and it will help us.
And there's an algorithm that likes this. So
yes.
It matters. It's not just sending a bouquet.
It's not just vanity. I mean, it's a little bit of vanity, right? I mean, it's a tiny bit of vanity.
Yes, you are speaking to Mr. Algorithm.
Yes.
I have to say that...
The great Steve Jobs in the sky reaches down and helps us out on iTunes.
I had a moment of philosophical reflection last night, JVL, where I was thinking of all the blessings in my life, and the only thing I needed to feel complete was your hot take on Chris Christie's new book.
Amazingly,
I wake up in the morning and there it is. The 15 things that you need to know about Chris Christie's book. And as a result, I not only don't have to read the entire book, I don't have to pay for him, give him any money. On the other hand, I got all the good stuff.
Public service. I'm here to help the people. It's a big fat book of 400 pages. You see what I did there?
I did.
And I slogged through the entire blessed thing so that neither you nor AB nor anybody else in America has to, because this is an unattractive book. Holy crap. And I was early on Chris Christie. I was following him around when he was still chasing John Corzine, and I have followed him very closely throughout his political career. I have a very soft spot for him as a Jersey guy myself. And the Christie who is in this book is unrecognizable. He's like a 16-year-old girl writing about how all the mean people were mean to him and how they're just liars and snakes. And you know, his friend Donald, they are so close. And Donald thinks of him as a peer. And he was really the only person on the whole campaign who was a peer of Donald. Everybody else was just a little sycophant running around and yapping like lapdogs. But he, Chris Christie, was an executive and was the same sort of age as Donald. They had this great rapport. And they could talk to each other and really talk. And Chris Christie could tell Donald Trump things that nobody else would. And the truth is, Donald Trump offered him job after job after job in the administration. And he just didn't want to take any of them. And then at the end, I don't know if you guys knew this, but it was actually Chris Christie who broke up with Trump. And there's this scene where he literally, it's me. He comes to Trump Tower and Trump says to him, "I can't do a meeting. I'm too tired." He gives him the, "Sorry, I have a headache, honey." And Christie says, "No, I don't need a meeting, Donald. I just came to say goodbye." And they have this, and he's like, and I put my hand on his arm and I said to him, "There are people around you who don't want us to be together. And I'm not going to let that get in the way of our friendship." He's like all the breakup lines. Like, "It's not you, it's me. I don't want this to affect our friendship." But it's amazing.
Does he address the going and getting him the McDonald's hamburgers?
Doesn't do that.
Because I was wondering about that. Does he talk about the adoring stare press conference?
He talks about that, and he says, "You know, look, it's nothing, you know, like it was weird. He wanted me to stand up there. And what do you do? If you like look at him or react, you look weird. If you smile, you look weird." Like, this is, again, fact check false. All these things
are false. Like he's new at this. Like he's never done this before.
He talks about the beach photo, you know, the beached photo. You see what I did there? And he says, amazingly enough, he had been spending the entire weekend working hard on the people's business. And for 1 hour, and only 1 hour in the whole weekend, he went out onto the beach purely at his wife's urging. He, Chris Christie, the brave teller of truth, did not want to go to the beach, but his wife asked him to, and he went. And it just so happened that in the 1 60-minute window in which he spent time on the beach, that's when the Star Ledger's airplane happened to be flying past them. It is an amazing coincidence. And when I say all this is so sad, it's because Chris Christie's entire shtick was, "Look, this is me, warts and all, then I'm going to tell you things the way they are. And you may not like those things, and I may not like those things. They may be hard truths that are unpleasant, but that's just it. You could take it or leave it. That was his self. That was his essence as a political commodity. And now he's just like this crying little guy trying to position himself for something else like all the rest of them. And I found that deeply sad.
Well, and he hasn't been tweeted at yet, so I'm sure he's waiting around for that. I mean, this seems to be the magic for anyone with a book. Please, could the president would tweet about me? So here's my small anecdote. This morning, I was supposed to be on MSNBC to talk about something that I really didn't want to talk about, and they bumped me because they said the Chris Christie went on for too long. They went on for Chris Christie, to which I responded, you know, you're all whatever you give Chris Christie is really too long. I have to admit, there was a time when I was a Chris Christie fanboy. When he came to Wisconsin a bunch of times to campaign for Scott Walker, I went to a number of the events, and I thought it was some of the most gifted political performance art I have ever seen. I mean, this guy was, of course, there was a couple of tells, the fact that he basically brought the entire New Jersey mafia along with him. He had the biggest entourage I've ever seen. But that moment, I can still remember. That moment, and AB, you remember this as well, when he decided that he was going to endorse Donald Trump during the primary, he was early, and it was a big movement because it was one of those – it was that category shift where you have, you know, allegedly serious people who are taking Trump seriously. So I can't – you know, part of watching Chris Christie, you know, wring his hands about Donald Trump, man, you know, what, you didn't know this before? That this just occurred to you later?
This is such an interesting phenomenon. The people that pretend that they had no idea this was coming. I follow this Twitter site called Trump Regrets. And people who regret voting for him pipe up and say...
Wait. I have to write this down.
Yes, no, you want to see this. Actually, a bunch of them poured in after the shutdown cave last Friday. It was very interesting. It had been dormant for a while, but it went wild last weekend. So people say, I can't believe this. No one believes what you say. You're so embarrassing. You lied to us. And it's like they didn't see it coming. They were asleep in 2015 and 2016. Christie, I remember speaking to personally before when he was in the race and before he endorsed Donald Trump. And it's looking back on that conversation, none of us are surprised, just like Jonathan pointed out. I mean, his tough guy, straight up, you know, bravado was his appeal. And the idea that he's like groveling for, I don't know now, some kind of new reputation that would afford him a new chapter in his career because he has not been chosen for attorney general, chief of staff, or whatever. And Trump actually...
But he could have been. He could have been, right?
No. Just like Mick Mulvaney, who's willing to do all the jobs. But Trump did sort of tweet at him without naming him. He said he's enjoying all the books. But when he watches people on TV talking about his presidency and everything he's done wrong, what he realizes is that he's inside the White House and they didn't become president. He did. So that was a fresh one that was obviously from
this
morning,
so
pointed at Chris Christie and not at Cliff Sims, who wrote the Viper book. But, you know, it's I'm actually just having read whatever the first excerpts were that came out a couple weeks ago. I thought, oh, no. I mean, not even family members will be buying Chris Christie's book. But he has been on like 36 shows in the last 24 hours. So maybe he'll, you know, hit the 50 mark on Amazon.
Well, see, here's the way to JBL, going back to your summary, and you don't need to read the excerpt, just read JBL's piece. But there's still a suck up quality here, which yeah, is amazing. And he goes through all of the things that, you know, the incompetence and the ignorance and the you know, bizarre, you know, coterie of, you know, of hacks that he surrounded himself with. And then you said Christie refers to the Trump administration so far as a tragedy. And his implication is that it is totally, completely not the fault of the guy who does not understand government and is a terrible judge of character and ability and sits in the Oval Office watching TV all the time.
That's exactly right.
So clinging to something.
So you can see, I mean, the book is incredibly transparent. And what Christie is trying to do is he's trying to talk to Trump through the book. There are even a couple paragraphs earlier. We can just see Christie desperately hoping that somebody will highlight a sentence. You know, it's like the problem with these people is that they're weak and disloyal. You know, like this is a description which is meant for Trump's eyes and Trump's eyes only. And he wants back in. It's painfully obvious that he wants back in on this thing. And that's why he alibis Trump at every way. And he's constantly attacking. It's all the fault of the people around. Look, if Donald Trump was in the White House by himself, everything would be perfect. The problem is that he's got all of these people around him who are disloyal and terrible and liars and weak and stupid. And if only Donnie and Chris could have just held hands and done this together, just the two of them, everything would have worked out great. And the whole thing is, you know, I'll tell you what really bugged me about this. So, Chris, I don't know if you guys remember, the raison d'etre for his presidential campaign was entitlement reform.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was essentially running on the Paul Ryan, and he was the guy who was there to tell you, look, all of these things which you have and which you cling to and which are important to you, you got to understand that they are not sustainable, and you're going to have to take pain in order to fix this, or America is going down the toilet. And that was his the same pitch he gave to New Jersey when he was running for governor. It was, look, I am telling you something that is unpopular, that is going to hurt you personally, but we got to fix it. We got to hold hands and bite down on this stick here together and fix it all. And then he goes and endorses the only guy in the race who is explicitly against reforming entitlements. I mean, literally, like, everybody else in the race at least paid lip service to the idea of, well, yeah, sure, at some point we got to think about reforming Medicare, although I don't know what you need to do. And Trump is the one guy saying, I promise you, I am not going to touch your Medicare or Social Security, no matter what.
Yeah, never mind.
And this is so, Chris. You're like, this is like, you know, it's like Rand Paul, who's Mr. Non-Interventionist, then turning around and endorsing Rubio or something. You know, I mean, it's this insane thing.
So, who comes off the worst in this book?
Aside from Christie.
Right. Yeah, this is really, it's a 400-pound self-own, isn't it?
It's not. Good.
But he goes after Jared. It is an opportunity to avenge the Jared.
It is an opportunity to avenge the Jared fight. I think Jared doesn't come off all that terribly, frankly. I mean, Jared's...
Okay, then just Charlie Kushner.
Jared comes off... You know who comes off badly? I would say really, really badly. Yeah. Is Reince.
Oh, okay. Reince. I was going to ask you about Kasich, but let's do Reince first.
Oh, Kasich is terrible. So Kasich makes one page of appearance in the the book. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Reince comes off terribly. I mean, Reince comes off as a guy who is constantly spinning and trying to have his foot in both worlds and just weak and no ideas. And this is without Christie really trying to go after him. I mean, this is, I would say Christie seems to be playing it reasonably straight with Reince. The Kasich thing is fantastic. Kasich appears for one page when he calls Christie after New Hampshire. So Christie drops out after New Hampshire, and Kasich calls him, and he says to him, Chris, you know what your problem was? Christie says to him, no, I don't. Why don't you tell me? He says, you know what? You just go out there trying to play shortstop, but God wanted you to play right field, and you wouldn't listen to God. You just kept going out to shortstop, going out to shortstop, going out to shortstop, but you're a right fielder. And then you get in there, shortstop, and put yourself in the game, and the ball went right through your legs.
Unbelievable.
And so Christie says to him, well, John, what does God want you to do? Kasich says to him, you just watch, and I think it's going to be abundantly clear over the next couple months.
Oh, dear.
You just think to yourself,
Wow.
So in retrospect, what did God want John Kasich to do? Since he was like the guy, you know, in the peanut gallery, just yelling, you know, yelling random things throughout the game.
Amazing,
right? I mean,
right,
what?
No, amazing.
What was his role?
I did.
I mean, what?
It's an amazing, and there is, I would say, if you spend time close to politics, Kasich's reputation within the industry is exactly the opposite of his public persona. His public persona is as a very reasonable, nice, aw shucksy kind of guy. Political professionals, I don't think I'm talking out of school, tend to loathe him, like really seriously loathe him with a type of contempt that they don't normally have for their principles. I mean, all political professionals look down on their principles, right? I mean, they think, well, yeah, like this is just the guy paying the bills, right? There's another one next month. People in the industry do not like John Kasich, and this was maybe the first and best look behind that curtain as to why that I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, because the assumption is that he's a four-letter word that begins with a D. This latest story, did you guys catch that story where he was apparently, you know, bumped some woman who was some comedian from First Class? I mean, that was a D move, you know. And there was nothing implausible about it, right? So he was supposed to be bumped out of First Class, but he wouldn't leave.
Yeah.
So somebody else got bumped.
Yeah, now that's
she was
like
gracious about it.
President.
He was, no?
But it's so smart because it'll never end up on social media or anything.
Yeah, oh, it's that first class seat was so important.
But it's so interesting. I've covered Kasich, you know, back in the house, so I've known him a really long time, and I know his grumpy side. I know his empathetic side. I know his really endearing side. I know how smart and sort of dogged he was about, you know, policy that is important to him. Back then, it was much more conservative than it was in Ohio, where he became sort of this really empathetic, still a conservative, but really more of a kind of a populist and more wedded to a safety net. And so he's complicated in every way. I did keep a quote from Newt Gingrich that he gave to the National Journal in, I think, early 2015. We thought, you know, everyone was looking at the candidates, and it was, I don't have it memorized, but it's basically that I think I've used it in at least three columns, that basically Gingrich said that he didn't have the presidential temperament because Kasich is known to sort of, you know, grump out and be rude to people, which is hilarious. But Gingrich saying that before he became like a guy who would write three books on Trump and, you know, elevate him to this great historical figure. But Kasich
when Newt says you have a temperament problem.
Right. Right. So then, you know, we see him kind of evolve into this, like he's, you know, represented this most important battleground twice, and he's, you know, he flamed out of the presidential campaign, and then he, you know, was he going to be a threat in 2020 in terms of running as an independent? And people saying to him, you know, you can't do this because, you know, you just hand the election to Trump again, basically like the preview of Howard Schultz, but this is, you know, last summer or whatever. And now he's on CNN, which means I think that he's not going to run. And I think he just wants to be a part of the conversation. So I think that's why he wants to be on TV, sort of talking about, you know, other leaders and talking about the campaign. But I don't think,
you know, that's actually, this sort of occurred to me. Abby, you made a really good point here. When he signed with CNN, it probably was a pretty good indication he wasn't running for anything.
Right.
And because they must have had that conversation, because they wouldn't want, I mean, I see that Steve Schmidt has been basically is no longer an MSNBC contributor because he's advising Howard Schultz, which I thought was interesting.
I don't know about this, Charlie.
Remember when Flake signed on with CBS, it was, you know, he said he's not run.
But remember, Kasich went from the House to Fox, and he had a show on Fox. And he was really good at it, and he used TV to sort of reinvent himself and then catapult back into politics.
But we're so close to 2020. Can you imagine that CNN would be cool with that?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a real question.
No.
I don't know. Part of me wonders if you're Jeff Zucker, Zucker's CNN, right? Isn't he?
Yeah.
Running CNN? Yeah.
Yep.
If you don't look at all this as like an extra frisson of like maybe gives him some heat, right? I mean, look, if people put Corey Lewandowski on as a bipartisan analyst who's there to trust, who'd be trusted, then they'll put anybody on, right? I mean, this is...
Well, that's true. I mean, obviously the bar's pretty low.
CNN,
I remember,
right?
John Kasich.
Who's Corey?
Yeah. I don't think Corey's on any.
He got bumped.
He's not an analyst anymore. But
he
does a lot of TV appearances because he and Dave
Bossy
had two Trump books out in the same year.
Yeah,
6 months apart.
Yeah.
So I was on Hardball with Corey Lewandowski and accused him of being a Vesuvius of BS. So it was, you know,
right.
But so I did run into Kasich relatively recently, and clearly he remembered everything that happened in the Wisconsin primary, because I think the first words he said when one of his aides, you know, introduces him, was, well, thank you for everything you did for me. And then he turned and walked away. And then the aide goes after him. Well, because I wasn't out of, you know, I thought he was going to divide the anti-Trump vote. I mean, that's when I thought that, you know, Wisconsin was going to be this firewall of rationality. We know how that turned out. You know, and it wasn't quite clear why he was in the race at the time and then why he abruptly quit after Indiana. Well, he remembers everything. So the guy goes after him and basically says, you should probably, you know. So he comes back and I'm standing there with Eli Stokels, who was with the LA Times. And he goes off and he's trying to be nice. He's kind of like a guy pretending to be nice. And then he goes off on a rant about how he was absolutely right about Medicaid expansion. And then again, just abruptly stops and, you know, goes off to the makeup room or something like that. And it was like, what the hell was that about? I mean, what, you know, here's a guy who's been relatively successful in politics who has at least in my brief experience, absolutely zero, you know, personal interrelation skills in any case. Okay, so let's talk about the news of the day. So, AB, I am unclear. Would you be the Trump whisperer here? Is it a wall or is it not a wall? Okay, I mean, so the Trump has been trying to give himself an exit ramp for days now. Okay, it's not a wall. Okay, it's a screen. Okay, it's barriers, and everybody is, all of the usual media sycophants are going along and saying, yeah, it's just a barrier and all of this. And then he's tweeting out today, let's call a wall. And in case you missed the point, he's capitalizing it. So is it a freaking wall or what? I mean, what?
I think it's a wall. And I think that he's back on a previous talking point, which, like many of his talking points, are inconsistent, which is that we have a wall and that it's already built. And surprise, surprise, the whole shutdown was like pointless. And this conference committee is also pointless because there's already a wall. And don't worry, he's got it all covered, is the last tweet I read. So here we are, you know, millions of people affected later, a hit to GDP later, people rationing medicine and all these things. And he says there's a wall and it's being built and it's like, no problem. And we're all
okay.
Good.
So there is no crisis. The crisis has been canceled.
I guess that's a good way of putting it. I mean, I think that the conferees will be delighted to hear that they can basically just do some straightforward, like, sensor detecting equipment appropriations at some different parts of the border and just be done with it.
And he will stand in front of nothing. I picture this. He's going to stand in an open field and he's going to point and he's going to say, and see, I have built it. I have built this big, beautiful wall. And you know that Hugh Hewitt will write a column saying, you know, Trump has outsmarted them all.
Yes.
But
I am
struck by this, yeah. Because, I mean, last week we were being, you know, women were being raped. We were being murdered in our beds.
There's,
you know,
a lot
there
of duct
was
tape.
Human trafficking. Yeah. There was a lot of duct tape. And apparently that got fixed.
Yes. But, you know, the you can count on him coming back with some caravan crisis talk. I mean, you know, there's that's what I have actually been keeping a stack of these tweets on my desk, including Laura Ingraham and Ann Coulter in December saying, why do you keep saying this? There is no wall. Why do you keep saying it's been built? And so I do expect more caravan crisis talk. Just, you know, that's sort of how he rolls. Don't rule it out.
Yeah, I'm watching people ping pong back and forth on whether or not he's going to cave in on all of this and whether or not the base goes along with him. And it is remarkable, though, the ability of people to adjust on the fly.
Oh, completely.
I mean, you really have to be nimble these days, don't you?
Yes.
With Donald Trump.
I mean, there's still all these different scenarios. Like, you have Lou Dobbs mad at him, Sean Hannity saying that the money's going to come, Trump saying the wall's been built, and at the same time, his officials at the White House today are saying that the national emergency declaration is still on the table. He can still pull that out. And you know, I do think that there's, you know, real fear among Senate Republicans who are now pretty out in the open in the last week since the cave happened on Friday and the government reopened, that Texas is a battleground. Senator John Cornyn went on the record about this with the Washington Examiner, saying that that the Republican Party of Texas has flipped out, that Trump, the president, could lose the state. I think that there's, you know, real tension now about whether or not he understands that he can't have another shutdown. And what will he say about that in the State of the Union? And how is he going to proceed both before and on February 15th? And there's real uncertainty about whether or not the president gets it. But you can really tell the Senate Republicans have gotten it. You can tell that Mitch McConnell is done and that he pushed those senators out to vote for the Democratic proposal on purpose, and that he has he's shutting down the shutdown. So does that set up a veto thing? I mean, it's still really a fear on the Republican side that he will continue to underestimate the Democrats on the House side, that he'll continue to underestimate the damage it's doing to them electorally, and that, you know, he'll change his mind at any moment. And so I think that it's amazing how his conservative allies in the media adjust to, you know, the virtual realities and the no wall, see-through wall, beaded curtain, whatever's going on. But but I don't know that the senators can continue to contort themselves much longer when it comes to shutting the government down.
I think JBL and I agree on this. I was profoundly disappointed to hear that the State of the Union was back on. I thought this was the one thing, the one little bit of progress that we had made, that we weren't going to have to go through the State of State of the Union, but no, we got to go through this. I'm just dreading the whole thing.
I think I know, and it's just to me, I think it's wildly inappropriate until this is actually resolved. And I think if you think about it from a political sort of strategy standpoint, it would be better for Trump if he was able to come out after this was over with and say that he had a complete victory and like do a PR, you know, spin and just move on. While as you know, on Tuesday the 5th. This is all going to be still up in the air and a volatile situation. I don't think it's really a great time, you know, to score that win and have a political speech if you're still in the wilderness on this issue and scaring Republicans. I don't understand why do it on Tuesday.
So, JVL, do you watch these speeches or?
Historically, I have. God, they're horrible. I mean,
they're horrible, really, and they're getting worse. Yeah.
They're the worst kind of speeches. And I, as somebody with a lot of friends in the speechwriting community, I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for the people who have to write these things because you're serving like 15 different masters.
Yeah,
you've got the president, the chief of staff, then you have all of the cabinet agencies fighting to get their paragraph placed three places higher or two extra sentences, and they're all trying to cut one another. And you, the speechwriter, are the one who's like in the middle and turned into the villain and all of this. And the speeches are a dog's breakfast. I mean, they're not actually speeches. They are long laundry lists of half-baked ideas, none of which ever come to anything. I mean, this is, you know, like...
Right.
The State of the Union is not where you get the actual report on what's going to happen legislatively in the coming year. It's always... Because that's always boring. What you do instead is you tell people the things they would kind of like to hear and in a fantasy world would like to get in the coming year, but that you're never going to pursue.
Where does that phrase, dog's breakfast, come from? Because last couple of days, when I get up, I go into the kitchen, and there's this gorgeous, you know, buffet laid out of, you know, eggs and steak and beef and smells fantastic. And I say, is this breakfast? And my wife says, no, it's for the dogs. This is our three dogs. That's I mean, I understand that, oh, my God, they eat better than me. That's amazing. Has been the thing. And it's like, so the phrase dog's breakfast, I'm thinking, you know, I want to keep the dog's breakfast. It's going to come to a point if this polar vortex goes on too long that I'm going to be eating their stuff. Really. You know, I mean,
it's funny you say that. I had a friend who was in Rome a couple of years ago and they texted me a picture of a room service menu from the room of their hotel. And it was a separate room service menu for dogs.
Oh, wow. Mm.
And I believe the cheapest item was like 20 euros and went all the way up to like 100 euros for like some item of food for room service for your dog.
Oh, my God.
And that was the moment when I was just like, this is peak dog. I'm out. I can't do this
anymore. No, see, if my wife listens to this podcast, which she will, she'll probably be on, you know, looking it up, Googling, you know, hotels, Rome, dogs, you know, because this would be the... Okay, I have to ask you guys something, and I'm sorry that I didn't give you guys a heads up that I wanted to talk about this, but I'm trying to figure it out. Having been burned so many times in the last couple of weeks by seeing something... you know, on Twitter or a video and then leaping to the conclusion and finding out that it was misleading. Where are we at right now on the governor of Virginia's comments on partial birth abortion, post-birth infanticide that went absolutely nuclear yesterday? Is there any sort of this was out of context, that he did not mean this, that he wasn't talking about the baby being born and then resuscitated and then a conversation between the doctor and her mother that was not involving the possible killing of a newborn baby? I was appalled when I first read it. But given the current cycle, is there anything other than outrage here?
JVL, was there some kind of pushback from the Northam people that was taken out of context in the radio interview? Or
I have to plead ignorance because I spent literally my entire day yesterday.
You're a Chris Christie folk reader. I forgot.
I literally spent the entire from
you're hiding behind Chris Christie,
and it's easy to do.
I remember.
See what I did there?
Oh yes, yeah, that was brutal. Okay. The beach picture. Yeah. So I actually of all of Jonathan's work on this exhausting project, I most appreciated the JVL threatening tweet that I have read the book, all of it, and I will be tweeting nonstop about that Chris Christie book. It prepared me. But no, I did see on Fox last night on Brett Baer's show, he did run the clip from the Northam interview, and I saw what I thought was in its entirety. He starts to sort of stumble at the end about what happens after birth and the consulting and everything. It, maybe he sort of slows down, but it, I think it was pretty clear what he was saying and that the response has been appropriate. I don't know that we're talking about a misunderstanding here.
Well, because that is the key question. If there was a misunderstanding, he should have pushed back. He should have clarified, unless we're in the position right now where he's afraid to push back or clarify because he would be dragged by the other side on all of this. But, you know, these new abortion laws in Virginia and New York, I don't think have received, you know, nearly enough attention. But another one of the items on the are the Democrats going to overplay their hand because they cannot help themselves overplaying their hand. Did you see Steve Hayes's tweet this morning where he basically said, look, there's a lot of Trump skeptical conservatives who are not going to align with the Democrats, and then runs down the list, you know, including this story and then the 7% income tax, the wealth tax, all of the other things as the Democratic Party decides to lurch left. ABJVL, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it very, very much. Particularly, so what is the temperature there in D.C.? So you had to brave the...
I believe it was -7 when I drove in this morning.
Oh, really?
No, it's now 19, but when we got up, it was 8.
How are you, Charlie?
Well, it's still around, you know, -20 here. that's without doing the wind chill factor, you know. And so I'm watching all these videos of people taking, if this is a big thing here in the Midwest, where you take boiling water and you go outside and you throw it up in the air and it turns to snow. Have you seen that?
No, it's
really awesome. Cool. You can do that. It is so cold. You take a cup of boiling water, throw it in the air, and it turns into snow, which, of course, is absolutely pointless because what I'm most concerned about is what is the temperature at which dog pee freezes in the air? Because this has practical implications for my life.
I am not a dog person. Is it safe to take your dogs out in weather like this?
No. That's why we have all the pictures.
This is why they're giving the banquet to the German shepherds with all the people food being cooked gourmet styles because they're trapped and they're frustrated.
And to compensate for the fact that they have to wear hoodies and boots and vests, we've posted some of the pictures, and I will say that the German shepherds have been, you know, they've been good sports, but the humiliation runs deep, and there's going to be revenge. So
I love the Charlie Sykes bundled up dog pictures. It's one of my favorite. This has gotten me through the last few days, actually, despite Chris Christie's book.
Something's got to. Thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, or maybe even sooner, and we'll do this all over again.